For collapse of one or more levels, see support columns under Sabotage, page 751. For fire outbreak, see Sabotage? Lucas flipped a few pages and read something about air handling and asphyxiation. Who came up with all this stuff?
People who have experienced many bad things.
Like... He wasn't sure if he was allowed to say this, but it felt like taboos weren't allowed down there. Like the people before the uprising?
The people before those people, Bernard said. The one people.
Lucas closed the book. He shook his head, wondering if this was all a gag, some kind of initiation. The priests usually made more sense than this. The children's books, too.
I'm not really supposed to learn all this, am I?
Bernard laughed. His countenance had fully transformed from earlier.
You just need to know what's in there, so you can access it when you need to.
What does it say about this morning? He turned to Bernard, and it dawned on him suddenly that no one knew of his fascination, his enchantment with Juliet. The tears had evaporated from his cheeks. The guilt of possessing her forbidden things had overpowered his shame for falling so hard for someone he hardly knew. And now this secret had wandered out of sight. It could only be betrayed by the flush he felt on his cheeks as Bernard studied him and pondered his question.
Page 72, Bernard said,
the humor draining from his face and replaced with the frustration from earlier. Lucas turned back to the book. This was a test. A shadowing rite. It had been a long time since he'd performed under a caster's glare. He began flipping through the pages and saw at once that the section he was looking for came right after the pact, was at the very beginning of this new order. He found the page. At the very top, in bold print, it said, "In case of a failed cleaning." And below this rested terrible words strung into awful meaning. Lucas read the instructions several times, just to make sure. He glanced over at Bernard, who nodded sadly, before Lucas turned back to the print. In case of a failed cleaning, prepare for war. 17. Poor living corpse, closed in a dead man's tomb. Juliet followed Solo through the hole in the server room floor. There was a long ladder there and a passageway that led to 35, a part of 35 she suspected was not accessible from the stairwell. Solo confirmed this as they ducked through the narrow passageway and followed a twisting and brightly lit corridor. A blockage seemed to have come unstuck from the man's throat, releasing a lone, stricken torrent. He talked about the servers above them, saying things that made little sense to Juliet, until the passageway opened into a cluttered room.
"My home,"
Solo said, spreading his hands. There was a mattress in one corner resting directly on the floor, a tangled mess of sheets and pillows trailing off. A makeshift kitchen had been arranged across two shelving units, jugs of water, canned food, empty jars and boxes. The place was a wreck and smelled foul, but Juliet figured Solo couldn't see or smell any of that. There was a wall of shelves on the other side of the room stocked with metal canisters the size of large ratchet sets, some of them partially open.
"You live here alone?" Juliet asked. "Is there no one else?"
She couldn't help but hear the thin hope in her voice. Solo shook his head.
"What about further down?"
Juliet inspected her wound. The bleeding had almost stopped.
I don't think so, he said. "Sometimes I do. I'll find a tomato missing, but I figure it's the rats."
He stared at the corner of the room.
"Can't catch 'em all," he said. "More and more of them."
"Sometimes you think there's more of you, though? More survivors?"
She wished he would focus.
"Yeah."
He rubbed his beard, looked around the room like there was something he should be doing for her, something you offered guests.
"I find things moved sometimes, find things left out. The grow lights left on, then I remember I did them."
He laughed to himself. It was the first natural thing she'd seen him do, and Jules figured he'd been doing a lot of it over the years. You either laughed to keep yourself sane, or you laughed because you'd given up on staying that way. Either way, you laughed.
Thought the knife in the door was something I did. Then I found the pipe. Wondered if it was left behind by a really, really big rat.
Juliet smiled. I'm no rat, she said. She adjusted her tablecloth, patted her head, and wondered what had happened to her other scrap of cloth. Solo seemed to consider this.
So, how many years has it been? She asked.
34,
he said, no pause.
34 years? Since you've been alone?
He nodded, and the floor seemed to fall away from her. Her head spun with the concept of that much time with no other person around.
How old are you? She asked. He didn't seem all that much older than her.
50, he said. Next month, I'm pretty sure.
He smiled. This is fun, talking. He pointed around the room.
I talk to things sometimes, and whistle.
He looked straight at her.
I'm a good whistler.
Juliet realized she probably wasn't even born when whatever happened here took place.
How exactly have you survived all these years? She asked.
I don't know. I didn't set out to survive for years. Tried to last for hours. They stack up. I eat, I sleep, and I...
He looked away, went to one of the shelves and sorted through some cans, many of them empty. He found one with the lid hinged open, no label, and held it out toward her.
Bean?
He asked. Her impulse was to decline, but the eager look on his poor face made it impossible.
Sure,
she said, and she realized how hungry she was. She could still taste the brackish water from earlier, the tang of stomach acid, the unripe tomato. He stepped closer, and she dug into the wet juice in the can and came out with a raw green bean. She popped it into her mouth and chewed.
And I poop, he said bashfully while she was swallowing. Not pretty.
He shook his head and fished for a bean.
I'm by myself, so I just go in apartment bathrooms until I can't stand the smell.
In apartments? Juliet asked.
Solo looked for a place to set down the beans. He finally did, on the floor, among a small pile of other garbage and bachelor debris.
Well, nothing flushes, no water. I'm by myself.
He looked embarrassed.
Since you were 16? Juliet said, having done the math. What happened here 34 years ago?
He lifted his arms.
Oh, what always happens? People go crazy. It only takes once.
He smiled.
We get no credit for being sane, do we? I get no credit, even from me, from myself. I hold it together and hold it together, and I make it another day, another year, and there's no reward. Nothing great about me being normal, about not being crazy.
He frowned.
Then you have one bad day, and you worry for yourself, you know? It only takes one.
He suddenly sat down on the floor, crossed his legs, and twisted the fabric of his coveralls where they bunched up at his knees.
Our silo had one bad day, was all it took.
He looked up at Juliet.
No credit for all the years before that. Nope. Hey, you want to sit?
He waved at the floor. Again, she couldn't say no. She sat down away from the reeking bed and rested her back against the wall. There was so much to digest.
How did you survive? She asked. That bad day, I mean, and since.
She immediately regretted asking. It wasn't important to know, but she felt some need, maybe to glimpse what awaited her, maybe because she feared that surviving in this place could be worse than dying on the outside.
Staying scared, he said. My dad's Castor was the head of IT of this place. He nodded. My dad was a big shadow, knew about these rooms, one of maybe two or three who did. In just the first few minutes of fighting, he showed me this place, he gave me his keys. He made a diversion, and suddenly I became the only one who knew about this place.
He looked down at his lap a moment, then back up. Juliet realized why he seemed so much younger. It wasn't just the fear, the shyness, that made him seem that way. It was his eyes. He was locked in the perpetual terror of his teenage ordeal.
His body was simply growing old around the frozen husk of a frightened little boy. He licked his lips.
None of them made it, did they? The ones who got out?
Solo searched her face for answers. She could feel the dire hope leaking out of his pores.
No,
she said sadly, remembering what it felt like to wade through them, to crawl over them. It felt like weeks ago rather than days.
So you saw them out there, dead?
She nodded. He dipped his chin.
The view didn't stay on for long. I only snuck up once in the early days. There was still a lot of fighting going on. As time went by, I went out more often and further. I found a lot of the mess they made, but I haven't found a body in, he thought carefully, maybe 20 years?
So there were others in here for a while? He pointed toward the ceiling.
Sometimes they would come in here with the servers and fight. They fought everywhere. Got worse as it went along, you know. Fight over food, fight over women, fight over fighting.
He twisted at the waist and pointed back through the other door.
These rooms are like a silo in a silo. They're made to last 10 years, but it lasts longer if you're solo.
He smiled. What do you mean, a silo in a silo? He nodded.
Oh, of course, he said. Sorry, I'm used to talking with someone who knows everything I know.
He winked at her, and Juliet realized he meant himself.
You don't know what a silo is.
Of course I do, she said. I was born and raised in a place just like this. Only I guess you could say that we're still having good days and not giving ourselves credit for them. Solo smiled.
Then what's a silo?
He asked. That teenage defiance bubbling to the surface. It's... Juliet searched for the words. It's our home. A building like those over the hill, but underground. The silo is the part of the world you can live in. The inside, she said, realizing it was harder to define than she thought.
Solo laughed. Well, that's what the word means to you, but we use words all the time without really knowing them.
He pointed toward the shelf with all the metal canisters.
All the real knowing is in those, everything that ever happened.
He shot her a look.
You've heard the term raging bull, or someone being bull-headed?
She nodded. Of course.
But what's a bull?
He asked. Someone who's careless or mean, like a bully.
Solo laughed. Oh, so much we don't know, he said.
He studied his fingernails.
A silo isn't the world, it's nothing. The term, this word, it comes from a long time ago, back when crops grew in the outside farther than you could see.
He waved his hand over the floor like it was some vast terrain.
Back when there were more people than you could count. Back when everyone had lots of kids.
He glanced up at her. His hands came together and kneaded one another, almost as if embarrassed to bring up the making of kids around a woman.
They grew so much food, he continued, that even for all these people that they couldn't eat it all, not at once, so they stored it away in case times got bad. They took more seeds of grain than you could count, and they would pour them into these great silos that stood above ground.
Above ground, Juliet said. Silos? She felt as though he must be making this up, some delusion he'd concocted over the lonely decades.
I can show you pictures,
he said petulantly, as if upset by her doubt. He got up and hurried to the shelf with the metal canisters. He read the small white labels on the bottom, running his fingers across them.
Ha! Ha! Ha!
He grabbed one. It looked heavy and brought it to her. The clasp on the side released the lid, revealing a thick object inside.
Let me,
he said, even though she hadn't moved a muscle to help. He tilted the box and let the heavy object fall onto his palm, where it balanced expertly. It was the size of a children's book, but 10 or 20 times as thick. Still, it was a book. She could see the edges of miraculously fine-cut paper.
I'll find it, he said.
He flipped pages in large chunks, each flap a fortune in pressed paper, clapping solidly against more fortunes.
Then he whittled his search down more finely, a pinch at a time, before moving to a single page at a time.
Here,
he pointed. Juliet moved closer and looked. It was like a drawing, but so exact as to almost seem real. It was like looking at the view of the outside from the cafeteria, or the picture of someone's face on an ID, but in color. She wondered if this book had batteries in it.
"It's so real,"
she whispered, rubbing it with her fingers.
"It is real," he said. "It's a picture, a photograph."
Juliet marveled at the colors, the green field and blue sky reminding her of the lie she had seen in her visor's false video. She wondered if this was false as well. It looked nothing like the rough and smeared photos she'd ever seen.
"These buildings,"
he pointed to what looked like large white cans sitting on the ground,
"these are silos. They hold seed for during the bad times, for when the times get good again."
He looked up at her. They were just a few feet apart, Juliet and him. She could see the wrinkles around his eyes, could see how much the beard concealed his age.
"I'm not sure what you're trying to say," she told him.
He pointed at her, pointed at his own chest.
"We are the seeds,"
he said.
"This is a silo. They put us here for the bad times."
"Who? Who put us here, and what bad times?"
He shrugged.
"But it won't work."
He shook his head, then sat back on the floor and peered at the pictures in the massive book.
"You can't leave seeds this long," he said. "Not in the dark like this, nope."
He glanced up from the book and bit his lip, water welling up in his eyes.
"Seeds don't go crazy," he told her. They don't. They have bad days and lots of good ones, but it doesn't matter. You leave them and leave them, however many you bury, and they do what seeds do when they're left alone too long."
He stopped, closed the book, and held it to his chest. Juliet watched as he rocked back and forth ever so slightly.
"What do seeds do when they're left too long?" she asked him.
He frowned.
"We rot," he said. "All of us. We go bad down here, and we rot so deep that we won't grow anymore."
He blinked and looked up at her.
"We'll never grow again."
18. If you had the strength of 20 men, it would dispatch you straight. The waiting beyond the stacks of supply was the worst. Those who could napped. Most engaged in nervous banter. Knox kept checking the time on the wall, picturing all the pieces moving throughout the silo. Now that his people were armed, all he could hope for was a smooth and bloodless transfer of power. He hoped they could get their answers, find out what's been going on in IT, those secretive bastards, and maybe vindicate Jules. But he knew bad things could happen. He saw it on Mark's face, the way he kept looking at Shirley. The worry there was evident in the man's frown, the tilt of his eyebrows, the wrinkles above the bridge of his nose. Knox's shift leader wasn't hiding the concern for his wife as well as he probably thought he was. Knox pulled out his multi-tool and checked the blade. He flashed his teeth in the reflection to see if anything from his last meal was stuck there. As he was putting it away, one of Supply's shadows emerged from behind the stack to let them know they had visitors.
"What color visitors?" Shirley asked, as the group gathered their guns and lurched to their feet.
The young girl pointed at Knox.
"Blue, same as you."
Knox rubbed the girl's head as he slipped between the shelving units. This was a good sign. The rest of his people from Mechanical were running ahead of schedule. He made his way to the counter while Mark gathered the others, waking a few, the extra rifles clattering as they were gathered up. As Knox rounded the counter, he saw Peter entering through the front door, the two supply workers guarding the landing having allowed him past. Peter smiled as he and Knox clasped hands.
Members of Peter's refinery crew filed in behind, their customary black coveralls replaced with the more discreet blue.
How goes it? Knox asked. The stairs sing with traffic, Peter said.
His chest swelled as he took in and held a deep breath, then blew it out. Members of Peter's refinery crew filed in behind, their customary black coveralls replaced with the more discreet blue.
How goes it?
Knox asked.
The stairs sing with traffic, Peter said.
His chest swelled as he took in and held a deep breath, then blew it out. Knox imagined the pace they'd maintained to shave off so much time.
Everyone's underway?
He and Peter slid to the side while their two groups merged, members of supply introducing themselves or embracing those they already knew.
They are, he nodded. I give the last of them another half hour, though I fear the whispers on Porter's lips travel even faster than we do.
He looked toward the ceiling.
I'd wager they echo above our heads even now. Suspicions?
Knox asked.
Oh, aye. We had a run-in by the lower market. People wanted to know the fuss. Georgie gave them lip, and I thought it'd come to blows. God, and not in the mids yet? Aye. Can't help but think a smaller incursion would have had a greater chance of success.
Knox frowned, but he understood Peter thinking so. The man was used to doing a great deal with only a handful of strong backs, but it was too late for them to argue over plans already in action.
Well, the blackouts have likely begun, Knox said. There's nothing to it but for us to chase them up.
Peter nodded gravely. He looked around the room at the men and women arming themselves and repacking their gear for another quick climb.
And I suppose we mean to bludgeon our way up? Our plan is to be heard, Knox said, which means making some noise.
Peter patted his boss on the arm.
Well then, we are already winning.
He left to pick out a gun and top up his canteen. Knox joined Mark and Shirley by the door. Those without guns had armed themselves with fearsome shanks of flattened iron, the edges bright silver from the shrill work of the grinder. It was amazing to Knox that they all knew, instinctively, how to build implements of pain. It was something even shadows knew how to do at young ages, knowledge somehow dredged up from the brutal depths of their imagination, this ability to deal harm to one another.
Are the others running behind? Mark asked Knox. Not too bad, Knox said. More that these guys made good time. The rest'll catch up. You guys ready?
Shirley nodded. Let's get moving, she said.
All right, then. Onward and upward, as they say.
Knox scanned the room and watched his mechanics meld with members of supply. More than a few faces were turned his way, waiting for some sign, maybe another speech. But Knox didn't have another one in him. All he had was the fear that he was leading good people to their slaughter, that the taboos were falling in some runaway cascade, and it was all happening much too quickly. Once guns were made, who would unmake them? Barrels rested on shoulders and bristled like pincushions above the crowd. There were things, like spoken ideas, that were almost impossible to take back. And he reckoned his people were about to make many more of them.
On me, he growled, and the chatter began to die down.
Packs rustled into place, pockets jangling with danger.
On me,
he said again to the quieting room, and his soldiers began to form up in columns. Knox turned to the door, thinking this was certainly all on him. He made sure his rifle was covered, tucked it under his arm, and squeezed Shirley's shoulder as she pulled the door open for him. Outside, two workers from supply stood by the railing. They had been turning the sparse traffic away with a made-up power outage. With the doors open, bright light and the noise of supply's machinery leaked out into the stairwell, and Knox saw what Peter meant by whispers traveling swifter than feet. He adjusted his pack of supplies, the tools, candles, and flashlights that made it seem as if he were marching to aid rather than war. Beneath this beguiling layer hid more bullets and an extra bomb, bandages, and pain salve for just in case. His rifle was wrapped in a strip of cloth and remained tucked under his arm. Knowing what it was, he found the concealment ridiculous. Looking at the others marching with him, some in welding smocks, some holding construction helmets, he saw their intentions were all too obvious. They left the landing and the light spilling from supply behind and began their climb. Several of his people from mechanical had changed into yellow coveralls, the better to blend in the mids. They moved noisily up the dimmed nighttime glow of the stairwell, the shiver of traffic from below giving Knox hope that the rest of his people would be catching up soon. He felt sorry for their weary legs, but reminded himself that they were traveling light. He tried his damnedest to picture the coming morning as positively as he could. Perhaps the clash would conclude before any more of his people arrived. Maybe they would end up being nothing more than a wave of supporters coming to join in the celebrations. Knox and McLean would have already entered the forbidden levels of IT, would have yanked the cover off the inscrutable machinery inside, exposing those evil, whirring cogs once and for all. They made good progress while Knox dreamed of a smooth overthrow. They passed one landing where a group of women were hanging laundry over the metal railing to dry. The women spotted Knox and his people in their blue coveralls and complained of the power outages. Several of his workers stopped to hand out supplies and to spread lies. It wasn't until after they had left and had wound their way up to the next level that Knox saw the cloth had come unwrapped from Mark's barrel. He pointed this out, and it was fixed before the next landing. The climb turned into a silent, grueling ordeal. Knox let others take the lead while he slid back and checked on the status of his people. Even those in yellow, he considered his responsibility. Their lives were hanging in the balance of decisions he'd made. It was just as Walker had said, that crazy fool. This was it. An uprising, just like the fables of their youth. And Knox suddenly felt a dire kinship with those old ghosts, those ancestors of myth and lore. Men and women had done this before. Maybe for different reasons, with a less noble anger caught in their throats. But somewhen, on some level, there had been a march like this. Similar boots on the same treads. Maybe some of the same boots, just with new soles. All with the jangle of mean machines in hands not afraid to use them. It startled Knox, this sudden link to a mysterious past. And it wasn't that terribly long ago, was it? Less than 200 years? He imagined if someone lived as long as Jean's had, or McLean for that matter, that 3 long lives could span that distance. 3 handshakes to go from that uprising to this one. And what of the years between? The long peace sandwiched between 2 wars? Knox lifted his boots from one step to another, thinking on these things. Had he become the bad people he'd learned about in youth? Or had he been lied to? It hurt his head to consider, but here he was, leading a recreation of something awful. And yet, it felt so right, so necessary. What if that former clash had felt the same? Had felt the same in the breasts of the men and women who'd waged it.